Good afternoon, everyone. I am so pleased that you are all here for the Humanities, Sciences, and Personhood track, our afternoon session. We have three wonderful presentations queued up for you, starting with one with Myron Penner, Philosophy, Trinity Western University, April Cordero, Biology, Point Loma Nazarene University, and Amanda Nichols, Chemistry, Oklahoma Christian University. They'll be presenting on the science of sex determination and the human person. Please join me in welcoming them.
Thank you all for coming to our talk, and want to begin today just by acknowledging some partners that were helpful in accumulating this research. This talk is based on a paper that grew out of a project funded by University of St. Andrews Science Engaged Theology Initiative that was specifically focusing on theological anthropology, and as many good things are, that was funded by the John Templeton Foundation. Here's an overview of what we're going to be doing today. We're going to start with some philosophical and theological preliminaries, just get some concepts out on the table, and then I'm going to hand things over to the scientists, who are going to talk about environmental influences on sex expression, as well as genetic variation of sex expression in humans, and the epigenetic contingency of sex expression for humans, and kind of talk through some of what we've learned through this research. And then we're going to wind up with thinking through some applications, both theological and philosophical, of the science for how we should think about human persons. So one thing that we wanted to start with is to just note that philosophers like to point out, let's see here, why are we not advancing? There we go. So philosophers sometimes find it useful to pay attention to this distinction between essential properties of a thing and contingent properties of a thing. And this is adjacent to two other concepts that philosophers often find helpful to point out. And that's just the distinction between the actual, how things are actually unfolding, versus the merely possible. A possible scenario is something that could have happened, but perhaps hasn't, right? And so the actual refers to how things are, and the merely possible refers to alternative ways things could have been. And this is relevant to this distinction between essential properties of a thing and contingent properties of a thing. And so if something is an essential property of an object, however that object continues its career through life, the essential properties are going to be with it throughout its whole career. But a contingent property of something is a property that something could acquire over time, perhaps lose, and there are multiple different scenarios in which an object can change contingent properties over time. So essential properties, a thing has come what may. Contingent properties, something that could be acquired or lost at different times. We thought it would be important to just to talk about our approach to science-engaged theology. And many of you will be familiar with the Wesleyan quadrilateral. And our particular spin on the quadrilateral is what we're calling a domain-specific, non-hierarchical Wesleyan quadrilateral. And the Wesleyan quadrilateral, of course, points out four different sources of authority that can guide our thinking as Christians, and they are scripture, reason, experience, and tradition. And we want to point out that our interpretation of the quadrilateral is to look at these authorities as domain specific. And by that, we mean that each domain, whether it's scripture, reason, or experience, has its own area of expertise. There are some things that scripture is wired to do, some things that reason, experience, and so on are particularly suited for. And we say that our approach to the quadrilateral is that it's non-hierarchical, which is to say you can't pick one of these authorities and hold it over all of the others in every circumstance. There are going to be some situations where scripture should take the lead. There are going to be some situations where reason, including science, should take the lead, experience, and so on. We also make a distinction between the first three, scripture, reason, and experience, on kind of one axis, and tradition on the other, which is to say that we like to think about tradition as the perspective of people in places and times other than our own on scripture, reason, and experience. And here we quote the rabbi Mordecai Kaplan, the ancient authorities are entitled to a vote, but not a veto. And so that's how we are thinking about these different domains as they're working together.
Thanks, Myron. So I'm going to talk a little bit about environmental influences on sex expression. So for many species, being biologically male or female at a time is a contingent property that depends on environmental factors. If the environment were to change, the sex expression would also change. So I'm going to share two examples we see in nature. That's how we're going to start off today. So this is an example you might be familiar with this. This happens in a type of fish, the blue-headed wrasse. So on the left, you see a yellow fish. That's the female. It's smaller than the male. And then the male fish has that white-black stripe with the blue head. It's larger as well. And in some of these fish groups, they have a harem. So they'll have a harem of many females, one male. The male mates with the females to reproduce. If something happens to the male fish, one of the females will transition to become the male of the harem. And so on the right side, you can see the female, that top yellow, smaller fish, in about 8 to 10 days will transition into a male blue-headed wrasse. The female's going from a fully functional reproductive female all the way to a fully functional reproductive male. Another example that we see in nature has to do with turtles, and specifically the temperature that the eggs are at. So this is a red-eared slider turtle. If we consider one egg that's been laid in the ground, early gonad has not gone down a female, typical female path or a typical male path yet. If it's just a, normal or average temperature, it's about a 50-50 split in terms of half the eggs will end up as female, half will end up as male. But scientists have discovered that if the temperature that the eggs are at, so the ambient temperature, will determine what pathway, and so most of the eggs will follow a certain pathway. So if the temperature is raised a few degrees, up to 31 degrees Celsius, you have the eggs will go to the female pathway, and the gonad will turn into an ovary. And then if the temperature drops by a little bit, it will go down the male pathway and develop into a testes. And so here's an example where the environmental factor, temperature, determines what pathway is going to be developed in terms of sex. So those are examples that we see, right? We're talking about fish, we're talking about turtles, but what about humans? So this is a question that we were interested in this project, and could a human zygote have followed a pathway of sex determination different from the path it followed in the actual world? So are humans like turtles and fish in this respect?
Thank you. So I'm going to start by, my name's April, giving you a little reminder of Bio 101. Egg, sperm come together and make a zygote. The zygote has all of the DNA. The DNA gets copied, and that one cell splits and make two cells. Now two cells have all the same DNA, correct? The DNA gets copied, splits, four. Now we get 8 cells, 16 cells. You with me on this? Remember that? Okay, so this is the pathway of how we get development in utero. So sex determination and the development of gonads leading to male or female anatomy depends on whether genes get expressed or not at different times and places in the course of development. So what does that really mean? Well, if you start with the embryo anytime before about week 5-6, that embryo has all of the information and cannot be differentiated anatomically or physiologically as whether it's going to be typically male or typically female. If you looked at the genetics, you could see the XX or the XY chromosome. As you recall, XX was female. XY tends to be typically male, right? But if you look at it physiologically, that embryo could follow either pathway at that point. It is around week 6 that some differentiation starts to begin. And so to best understand sex determination, I often try to use the analogy of like a Rube Goldberg, where you have a gene that gets expressed, and there's a protein, and that protein then binds onto DNA and expresses another gene, and then another protein binds onto DNA and expresses another gene, and you sort of get this signaling pathway. And at about week 6, we start triggering the signaling pathway, which can typically go on a female pathway or a male pathway. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a little bit more detail than that and then talk about a non-typical pathway. So I want you to just focus on your left, this side. And I just want you to look in, and WNT1, WNT4, these are proteins. This is related to those signaling pathways in the DNA. Let's just look at the top, WT1, in all males and females. This is a gene, and it gets released around week 5-6 in mammals. And if we follow along the top, it triggers a protein, it triggers a protein, and it triggers WNT4. When WNT4 gets triggered, it sort of locks it into a female pathway, typically, and you end up with ovaries and following the typical anatomy of female. An alternate is if you are an XY individual, a typical pathway is that WT1 that both XY and XX individuals have will bind onto that Y chromosome. SRY is then a protein that gets triggered and expressed. SRY then triggers something called SOX9 and FGF, and we get this signaling loop, which is a self-sustaining loop, which causes the embryo to then usually typically follow into the male pathway, and you get male anatomy and physiology and testes. Interesting thing about that signaling pathway, either one, is it represses the other pathway. So as you will see that line going up with that pair of scissors, if you follow that bottom pathway, when you get into that self-sustaining latch, where the DNAs, you know, they're signaling each other, SOX9 and FGF, it represses the female pathway. So in each egg and sperm, each individual has the whole female pathway involved, and the male pathway will repress that female pathway if SOX9 and FGF are expressed. So far, so good? Okay, this is the typical thing that happens, but let's talk about the other side of the screen. Imagine an XY individual. And we see this in nature, we see this happening with mammals, but we can also induce this with mice. You can increase that WNT4 in an XY individual mouse, and you can result in female genitalia. You can, in an XY individual, have a mutation that occurs on the SRY gene, which prevents that pathway going typical male, and you end up having a female genitalia. You can also have an XX individual that we see in nature, and the SRY ends up on the X chromosome. And this would happen at the production of the egg. We get crossover, and that little piece of SRY gene from the Y just gets put on the X. And what we end up is seeing an XX individual that has male genitalia, because it ended up following that bottom pathway where SOX9 FGF signaling occurred. Or you can have, because of a genetic mutation, you can have an increase in androgens. CAH is an increase in particular hormones that lead to ambiguous genitalia. So while there's a typical pathway for a typical male and a typical pathway for a typical female, and then we have the non-typical pathways, as a result of different contingent factors, I can result in the non-typical pathways being followed. All right, so we just talked about some genetics and some things that can happen in the genetics, but what about epigenetics? So epigenetics has to do with a change to the molecular structure of the DNA, not a change to those DNA molecules. So those nucleotide bases, A, C, G, and T, isn't changing. The structure of the DNA is changing. So this image is just showing you a chromosome with chromatin and their histones. You don't need all the details, but we can add little molecules to the histones. It causes change in the structure and if that DNA gets expressed or not. We can also have dcDNA methylation, and that will also tell us if the DNA gets expressed or not. And so these are things that can influence what occurs without changing the actual molecules of DNA, nucleotide bases. All right, so then we ended up with the question, epigenetic contingency of sex expression, can that happen in humans? Can we have these changes occur in humans? Well, what we can do is look at mice. And so if you look at the right side of the screen, it's a pretty complicated image that, you know, I can explain later to individuals that would like an explanation. But what we see in mice is that exactly what I said early on, you have an embryo that can become either a typical male or a typical female early on in its development. And messages cause genes to get expressed, proteins that lead it to a typical pathway. We can, with epigenetic factors, histone modification, which is the left side on the bottom or the right side of the bottom, the female genes and the male genes exist, not talking about the X and Y, just all the genes in our system. In a typical male, the female genes get repressed through histone modification, or the male genes can get repressed through histone modification, also resulting in leading to one of these pathways. So studies show that the effects on sex determination in mice can be because of regulation of SRY, the gene, via methylation, not because of genetic modification, but methylation, or regulation of SRY via histone modification, not a genetic mutation. So what about humans? Well, we cannot go in the lab and do these kinds of changes, obviously, experimental changes with humans. We see it with the mice, and we can do these histone modification changes with mice. And so the assumption is, if we could do this with humans, would we see that we could influence that developmental pathway in utero? So back to Myron.
So we have just a few minutes remaining, and I want to wrap this up by thinking through, what does the science teach us or suggest to us about what it means to be a human person? Ooh, back up. So one thing is that, as we've seen through the backdrop of nature, extreme contingency of sex expression and sex transition across lifespan is commonplace in nature. It's a widespread natural phenomena for many species with whom humans share DNA and common ancestry. It shouldn't be surprising then to find genetic and epigenetic factors for contingent sex expression in Homo sapiens, as we have with mice and rabbits. So what is that, how can we apply that to thinking about human persons? Well, biologically male and biologically female are not universally clear either or descriptors for humans. And there doesn't seem to be any biological basis for a fixed universal gender essentialism. What about having genetic potential to express a different biological sex? Well, the genetic information and potential to express sex differently is present in Homo sapiens as it is with other species, for which sex transition is commonplace and sex determination is highly susceptible to a range of environmental factors. Typical pathway male mammals, right? Humans who have followed a typical developmental male pathway have genes capable of facilitating female sex expression. It's just that typical pathway males will suppress these genes across lifespan. And similarly, typical pathway female mammals have genes capable of facilitating male sex expression. Typical pathway females will suppress these genes across lifespan. So the paths are parallel and both present. It's just that one is suppressed. As we've seen with the fish, the parallel paths are there, and they have easy access between one and the other. So what we think this means is that there's no basis, no biological basis for ontological injustice, right? Treating those who follow atypical biological pathways as, you know, ontologically less than in their capacity of being human persons. We also think that regardless of which developmental road of sex determination one is actually traveling, there are possible scenarios in which one could have followed a different developmental pathway, right? So this idea of if you rewound the tape of an individual's person's life and started from single-cell zygote and ran it out into multiple different scenarios, you could get a different path, a different developmental pathway that is followed. And April gave a nice job of laying out different developmental pathways. So for Homo sapiens, biological sex is contingent in that sense. but also in the second sense, which is to say that regardless of which developmental road of sex determination one is actually traveling, a different parallel path remains present throughout lifespan. And so we think when it comes to thinking through what this means for human persons, understanding the science should reduce, in some sense, the strangeness that some might feel at concepts like varying sex expression across lifespan for humans, or perhaps even reduce some of the strangeness that some might feel at the idea of introducing environmental interventions, including surgery and medicine, to facilitate sex transition. So we want to end with a reference to a trans theologian, Austin Hartke. And what we have here on the screen is a section from the manuscript of the paper that we've been working on. And what we say here is that given that sex transition is a commonplace, naturally occurring phenomenon among many species that reproduce sexually, Hartke, in his book, Transforming the Bible and Lives of Transgender Christians, who interestingly, he talks about the blue-headed wrasse and the science of sex determination and speaks from his experience as a trans person, thinks through how this could all fit both biologically and theologically into thinking about human persons and human populations. So he provides a model for thinking through how sex difference among human populations can fit within a wider biological and evolutionary context, a model which can alleviate some of the cognitive dissonance people may experience when contemplating various examples of sex difference and sex transition. So that is our paper. We don't have any time for questions, so thank you for coming.
Don't worry, there are actually time for questions. I'll get out here. Are there any questions? We need to do it into the microphone for the people online.
Would it be possible using DNA results from like 23andMe and Family Tree DNA ancestry to find the probability that somebody could be, for example, XY, but have come out as female and vice versa?
So could we, is it possible to use DNA information through 23andMe, Ancestry.com kind of information to calculate the probability that someone is following and is actually following a non-typical pathway? I don't know. I mean, there are other ways to determine whether or not a person is following a non-typical pathway. Interestingly, what we see sometimes when a couple is trying to conceive and there are fertility issues and they go in for testing, sometimes that's the first time that a person realizes that developmentally they've followed a non-typical path. There's a super interesting example of a man, I believe, in his 70s. This was written up just within the last 5 years. Father of four, grandfather, was going in for a hernia operation, and during the ultrasound, it was discovered that he had a womb. Right. So this is a person who had, through all of lifespan into senior life, it was discovered that he had followed a non-typical pathway. So I don't know in terms of using DNA data to calculate probabilities.
23andMe, if it's looking, I have 23andMe. I don't remember it telling me it's XX. Who is 23andMe out there? Is it telling me I'm XX or XY? I don't recall that. It does not. Yes, if people went in for genetic testing, it would say if they're XX or XY. But what do you do with that at that point? And that's always private information, so I don't believe it can be used for anything outside of that. I'm not sure that answers your question.
Is any information really private, though?
No, exactly. Exactly.
All right, we have another question back here.
Hi, thank you for addressing, which I think is a very important topic and that lots of thorns and struggles. And so thank you so much. This is a three-part question, which probably the three of you can answer together. First is that I don't know anything about amphibians, but I think there are animal systems where there is fluidity, right? They can change gender and then change it back if the circumstances warrant it. And in humans, even with the environmental pressures on the epigenetics, it does have a time point when it, when it's influential, and after a certain deterministic point, development progresses and you have features that you just, the person has. And so you know, how does the fluidity in animals compare to the lack of fluidity seen in humans? And then the third part would be, you know, how do we grapple with that concept of fluidity in social circles when gender fluidity is part of our everyday conversation? Thanks.
I'll do the bio.
Do it.
Okay, so you're absolutely right. So what we understand from mammal research and from the specialist Capo when we went to her lab is that among the mammals that have been studied, we don't see the transition in the mammals after a particular time period. In fact, at about week six, seven, in mice, there's a time period of about 6 hours where the typical female pathway would get diverted and change the typical male pathway. And if that window changes in mammals, that's it. It's following the typical male pathway. And it sort of gets locked in. And then there's a bunch of, she explained to us, the Capo Lab, who's a specialist in that, that there's a bunch of physiological mechanisms which actually prevent that transition to happening. Now, nobody knows why in mammals that's the case and why in amphibians and fish we see these abilities to transition between the typical male or the typical female. But we do know that it does sort of lock in at a particular phase. And but what you will end up with is there are some non-typical pathways. For example, an XX individual who has ambiguous genitalia and is raised up until puberty as a female, because it seems that that this is a typical female. And at puberty, a bunch of testosterone and other hormones get released that then cause the penis to develop. It then cause the breasts to not develop. So the female pathway at that that time would get repressed. Or not develop in the way you'd expect. A lot of these individuals then actually choose to then follow a male lifestyle because they feel that the cells are fully male. So that's not a change. That person was always XY. It's just that early on, the hormones didn't develop the anatomy of that XY individual until the hormones came at puberty time.
So just to maybe address the third part of your question, so the focus of our paper and our project was to really understand the biology and to get a good handle on what the best current science of sex determination is. We wanted to focus on the biology as opposed to starting with social concepts of gender, which, you know, obviously are different in different times and places, different social ideas about what, you know, masculinity and femininity count as. We wanted to focus particularly just on the biology. We think that the biology is relevant for larger social conversations about gender simply because lots of the discussion that happens at that level makes assumptions about how the biology works that really are not well-founded. Even, you know, all three of us have had different experiences talking about the blue-headed wrasse. And for some people who think that, you know, biological sex is fixed at conception and is immutable, for people who are unaware of the fluidity in some species, it's actually quite alarming to them because that's just not how they just made all sorts of assumptions about how biological sex works across all species. And so we think that there is value in providing data for reflection on social issues coming from the science. I think the hook is coming.
The hook is coming.
Super stern taskmaster.
Let's join me in thanking our presenters, please.